All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive. Today we're going back in time a bit, back to 1978, to a really pivotal California Supreme Court case, People v. Colley.
1978, wow, that's going way back.
Yeah, you know, the law moves slowly sometimes. But you shared some really interesting stuff with me, some materials about prosecutorial discovery and, you know, the whole world of attempted murder law.
Oh, yeah.
In this case, People v. Colley kind of sits right at the intersection of both of those topics.
Absolutely.
So I think this is going to be a really helpful deep dive for anyone trying to kind of get a handle on this really important California decision. What do you think?
I think that's right. And I think what makes Colley so interesting and so relevant even today is that it really highlights some of the tensions that are built into our system, our legal framework, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the tension between a defendant's constitutional rights, the prosecution's need to investigate, and the role of the courts in kind of making sure that both sides play fair.
Yeah, and trying to sort of strike a balance between those sometimes competing interests, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so why don't we start by, kind of laying out the facts of the case, setting the scene, if you will.
Okay, so Colley involves an assault. Mm. An assault on Bertram Colley's estranged wife. And I have to say the details are disturbing. She was bound, she was subjected to sodomy, and then Colley left her in a situation where she could have been killed by gas and a lit candle.
Oh, wow. So this was, a really serious situation, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
All right, so that's what Colley did, allegedly. What was his defense? How did he respond to these charges?
Well, his defense was basically twofold. First, he claimed that the sexual acts were consensual.
Okay.
And second, he presented an alibi. And the alibi witness was a woman named Cynthia Morris, and she testified that Colley was with her later that evening.
So he's saying he couldn't have done it, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Cynthia Morris, she's backing him up on that.
Right.
So this alibi is really important to his case.
It's extremely important, yeah.
Okay. So what happened next? Like, how did this play out in court?
Okay. So during the cross-examination of Cynthia Morris, it came out that she had spoken to a defense investigator.
Oh, so the defense team had done their own investigation, which, you know, is pretty common, right?
Right. They wanted to get their side of the story, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
But when the prosecution learned about this interview, they demanded to see the investigator's notes.
Oh, so this is where that prosecutorial discovery issue comes in, right?
Exactly. The prosecution say, hey, we want to see what's in those notes. It might be helpful to our case.
And the defense, I'm assuming, they objected to this pretty strongly.
You bet. They objected, and they cited both the work product privilege and the attorney-client privilege.
Right. So those are two pretty significant legal doctrines. Just to kind of remind our listeners, the work product privilege basically protects materials that are prepared for litigation. So it prevents one side from kind of snooping on the other side's strategy and preparation.
That's right.
And the attorney-client privilege, that protects confidential communications between an attorney and their client, right?
That's right. It ensures that clients can speak freely with their lawyers.
Okay, so those are the two privileges the defense was relying on to shield those investigators' notes.
Exactly. They didn't want to turn them over.
So what did the trial court do? Did they side with the defense?
No, they didn't. The trial court ordered the notes to be turned over to the prosecution.
Oh, wow. So despite those privileges, the prosecution got what they wanted.
That's right. And as you might expect, they then use those notes to try to impeach Morris's testimony.
Okay, so they're looking for inconsistencies, contradictions, anything that might cast doubt on her story.
Exactly.
All right, so what happened in the end? What was the outcome of the trial?
Well, Colley was convicted. He was convicted of attempted first-degree murder of his wife, attempted second-degree murder of his daughter. And remember, the daughter was in the house at the time of the assault and sodomy.
Wow, so those are some very serious charges.
Yes, very serious.
And he was found guilty on all of them.
That's right.
Okay, so what did he do next?
Well, he appealed, of course.
Yeah, makes sense.
And his appeal focused on two key issues. First, that the discovery order, the order to turn over the investigator's notes, was illegal. And second, that the jury instructions for attempted murder were wrong.
Okay, so that sets up the two main legal questions that the California Supreme Court had to grapple with.
Exactly.
So let's dive into that first issue, that forced discovery of the defense investigator's notes.
Right. So this issue really boils down to this question. Can prosecutors force the defense to hand over pretrial statements from their witnesses?
And that's a pretty big question, right? I mean, it gets to the heart of what's fair in the adversarial system.
Absolutely. I mean, it raises questions about the balance of power between the prosecution and the defense.
So what did the California Supreme Court say about this?
Well, The majority opinion really sided with the defense on this one. They emphasized the constitutional protections that are afforded to the defense, in particular the privilege against self-incrimination. You know, that's a Fifth Amendment right, and the work product doctrine.
Right, and we talked about those a little earlier. Those are pretty fundamental protections for the accused in a criminal case.
Exactly.
But I'm curious, what was the court's reasoning for pushing back against this kind of prosecutorial discovery? Like, what was the underlying rationale?
Well, a big part of it was this idea of judicial restraint.
Hmm.
Basically, the court was saying, look, creating these rules for prosecutorial discovery, that's really a job for the legislature, not for us.
Oh, so they're saying it's not really their place to make sweeping pronouncements about what information each side has to disclose.
Exactly. They're saying if the legislature wants to create those rules, that's fine, but we're not going to do it on our own.
And that makes sense, right? Because the legislature is the branch of government that's supposed to make the laws, and the courts are supposed to interpret them.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So the court was very clear about this. They said, and I'm quoting here, "We disapprove of any compelled production of defense evidence absent explicit legislative authorization."
Okay, so that's a pretty strong statement. They're basically saying, hands off prosecution unless there's a law that specifically allows you to do this.
That's right.
Now, I have a question about this. If the court found that the discovery order, that order to hand over the investigator's notes, was wrong, why weren't all of Cawley's convictions just automatically overturned?
That's a great question, and it gets to this idea of harmless error. It's a legal principle that says even if there's an error during a trial, an appellate court can still uphold a conviction if they determine that the error didn't really prejudice the defendant's case.
So it's like, yeah, there was a mistake, but it wasn't a big enough mistake to throw out the whole trial.
Right. And in Cawley's case, the court reasoned that even though the discovery order was wrong, it didn't actually change the outcome of the trial.
And how did they come to that conclusion?
Well, they said that Morris's testimony wasn't really crucial to Cawley's defense.
Hmm.
And they also felt that the other evidence against him, especially that whole setup with the gas and the candle, was just too strong.
So they're basically saying that even without the investigator's notes, even if Morris hadn't been impeached, Cawley was probably going to be convicted anyway.
That's right.
Okay, so that's the first big issue in the Cawley case. Let's move on to the second one, which is about the jury instructions for attempted second-degree murder.
Okay, so this issue centers on whether someone can be convicted of attempting second-degree murder based on this concept of implied malice.
And just as a refresher for our listeners, implied malice is basically when someone acts with such a reckless disregard for human life that it's considered the legal equivalent of intending to kill, even if they didn't consciously set out to do so.
Exactly.
So the question here is, can you attempt to do something that's based on recklessness rather than intent?
Right. Can you unintentionally attempt to murder someone?
That's a tricky concept.
It is tricky. And the California Supreme Court really had to draw a distinction here between specific intent and implied malice.
Okay, so specific intent means you had a conscious goal, a deliberate plan to do something, right?
Yeah.
And implied malice means you acted so recklessly that it's basically the same as intending to do something, even if you didn't actually intend to do it.
That's a good summary.
So what did the court say about how these concepts apply to attempted murder?
Well, they said that to be guilty of attempted murder, you have to have the specific intent to kill.
So you have to have that conscious goal of ending someone's life.
Right. Attempted murder can't be based on recklessness alone. It has to be intentional.
And that makes sense, right? Because attempt implies that you were trying to do something.
Exactly.
So how did this play out in Cawley's case?
Well, the trial court had instructed the jury that they could convict Cawley of attempted second-degree murder, even if they didn't find that he specifically intended to kill his daughter.
Oh, so they were basically saying that even if his actions were reckless, even if he didn't consciously want to kill her, he could still be guilty of attempted murder.
Right. But the California Supreme Court said that was a mistake. They said attempted murder always requires specific intent to kill.
So that's a really important principle that they established in this case, and it's still good law today in California.
Absolutely. It's a key point to remember.
Okay, so we've covered the two main issues in Cawley, but there's actually another interesting point that I wanted to touch on. It's about whether the trial judge had a duty to give the jury some specific instructions, even if the defense didn't ask for them.
You're talking about sua sponte instructions.
Yes, exactly. Sua sponte, which basically means the judge does something on their own initiative without being prompted by either side.
Right.
So in Colley's case, the issue was whether the judge should have instructed the jury about how to use evidence of Colley's past criminal conduct, even though the defense didn't specifically ask for that instruction.
Okay, so we're talking about limiting instructions. These are instructions that tell the jury they can only consider certain evidence for a specific purpose, and they can't use it to make broader judgments about the defendant's character.
Right. So, for example, they can't say, well, he did something bad in the past, so he must be guilty now. So, in Colley, what did the court say about the judge's duty to give these kinds of limiting instructions on their own?
They laid out a general rule. They said that judges only need to give these limiting instructions sua sponte, meaning on their own, if the evidence of past conduct is a really big part of the case, if it's highly prejudicial, and if it's not very relevant to proving the current charges.
It's kind of a balancing act, right?
Right. They're weighing the probative value of the evidence against the potential for unfair prejudice.
And in Colley's case, did they find that the judge had a duty to give a limiting instruction?
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
They said that his prior conduct wasn't central to the prosecution's case, so the judge didn't have to give an instruction without being asked.
Okay, so that highlights the strategic considerations for defense lawyers, right? They have to decide whether to request these limiting instructions or just let it go.
Exactly. It's a judgment call.
Now, before we wrap up, I think it's always interesting to look at where the justices on the Supreme Court agreed and disagreed. Do we see any of that in Colley?
Yes, definitely. There were some concurring and dissenting opinions that shed light on the different perspectives on the court.
Okay, so tell me about those.
Well, for example, Justice Newman concurred with the outcome of the case, but he had some doubts about whether it's really impossible to create fair rules for prosecutorial discovery.
So he agreed with the result, but he wasn't necessarily on board with the majority's reasoning about prosecutorial discovery.
Right. He thought maybe there's a way to do it fairly.
And what about the other justices?
Well, Justice Richardson went even further. He actually argued that the courts should be developing discovery procedures similar to what the federal courts do.
So he's advocating for a more active role for the courts in shaping these procedural rules.
Exactly. He thought the majority was being too cautious and was basically avoiding their responsibility to ensure fair procedures.
So it's a debate between judicial restraint and a more proactive approach.
Exactly.
Okay, so to wrap things up, what are the big takeaways from People v. Colley? What are the things that people should remember about this case?
Well, first, it established that in California, prosecutors generally can't force the defense to hand over statements from their witnesses without a specific law that allows it.
So that's a big win for the defense, right? It protects their ability to investigate and prepare their case.
Absolutely.
And second, the case clarified that attempted murder in California requires specific intent to kill. You can't be convicted of attempting a crime that only requires recklessness.
Right. And that distinction between intent and recklessness is really important.
Okay. And I think there's a broader takeaway here, too, right?
So that.
This case really highlights the separation of powers between the courts and the legislature.
That's a good point. The court is saying, we're not going to step on the legislature's toes. It's their job to create these rules.
Exactly. And it also shows how much strategy goes into litigation. Defense lawyers have to think carefully about when to request things like limiting instructions. Well, I think this has been a really insightful deep dive into People v. Colley. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did too. It's a fascinating case that touches on some really fundamental issues in criminal law and procedure.
I agree. It's a case that keeps on giving, even all these years later. It shows us that these debates about the balance between individual rights and the needs of law enforcement are still relevant today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining me for this deep dive.
It was my pleasure.
And to all our listeners out there, thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.
See you then.